Thank you very much, Michael, for that fantastic introduction. I may not be the happiest, but I certainly feel the most fortunate. I feel fortunate to live in such a fantastic country, and I feel fortunate to have such a great team around me at the Reserve Bank of Australia. So I do indeed feel fortunate. I was, though, looking forward to my first trip to Brisbane in 18 months today. But given the current lockdowns, that's going to have to wait. But I will get there as soon as I can, and I'll feel fortunate once again that I can be back in Brisbane. When I spoke at your lunch 2 years ago, I talked about the accumulation of evidence that Australia could sustain an unemployment rate below 5% without inflation becoming a problem. At that lunch, I also raised the possibility that the Reserve Bank would soon cut the cash rate to help secure both lower unemployment and inflation consistent with the target. As we all know, since then, a lot's happened. We've had a global pandemic and the biggest peacetime economic contraction in our lifetimes. And not only did the RBA cut the cash rate, but we cut it as far as we reasonably could. And the RBA's balance sheet has nearly tripled now to over $500 billion. So a lot's changed since that lunch 2 years ago. Even so, I would like today to return to the same two themes that I talked about 2 years ago. The first of those is the possibility of sustaining low rates of unemployment in Australia, and the second is how the RBA's monetary policy strategy is contributing to this. I plan to begin with a brief update of recent developments in the labour market. I'll then discuss the supply side of the labour market and its implications for wages and inflation outcomes. And finally, I'll turn to the Reserve Bank Board's decisions earlier this week. As you would all be aware, the recovery in the Australian market, the labour market this year has been remarkable. The number of Australians in a job has increased by over 250,000 since the turn of the year, and the level of employment is now 1% above its pre-pandemic level. As you can see in this chart, the unemployment rate has also fallen sharply, and it's now around the same rate as it was before the pandemic. This sharp decline in unemployment has come as a very welcome surprise. Back in February, it's not that long ago, we expected the unemployment rate now to be 6.5% and not reach the low fives until the second half of 2023, yet here we are now. Labour force participation is also near a record high. Underemployment's the lowest it's been in nearly a decade, and job vacancies are at a record high level as well. I think these outcomes point to the resilience of the Australian economy and the effectiveness of the health and economic policy response. One source of uncertainty in the near term, though, is the recent outbreaks of the virus and lockdowns. We're clearly watching developments here very carefully. But I think it is important to remember that Australia's experience has been that once an outbreak's contained and the restrictions are lifted, the economy and the jobs bounce back quickly, and I'd expect this to be the same here as well. It's noteworthy, though, that the positive surprises that we've experienced in terms of jobs and output have not been matched with equivalent surprises on wages and prices. You can see this in this next graph, which shows the wage price index. It increased by just 1.5% over the past year, and the recent outcomes have been broadly in line with our early expectations, and the same is true for inflation. Now, this combination of surprisingly positive employment growth and subdued wages growth had become familiar to us before the pandemic. You see this in the next couple of graphs. This first one shows the RBA's successive forecast for growth in the wage price index from 2014, and it also shows the actual outcomes, the black line here. I think the picture is pretty clear. Wages growth was persistently lower than our forecasts. The next graph is similar, but shows successive forecasts for the level of employment. The picture here is not quite as clear, but employment growth has mostly been in line with or exceeded our expectations, with the obvious exception of last year. As you would expect, we've been seeking to understand this experience, why it is that employment growth has been so strong and wages growth has been weak. So we're trying to understand this experience and its implications for our policy setting. One straightforward explanation is that low growth in wages encouraged firms to substitute labour for capital, with the result being that employment grew very quickly. The more important part of the story, though, is that the strong growth in labour demand was closely matched by a strong increase in labour supply. And with both demand and supply rising, there was little need for the price, that is wages, to move. There are three elements of the supply story that I'd like to talk about today. The first is the rise in labour force participation. Second is the ability of firms to tap into overseas labour markets when workers were in short supply in Australia. And the third factor is the trend rise in underemployment. So first to labour force participation, which has been trending up since the middle of the previous decade. And as you can see in this graph, it's currently around its record high. This upward trend in participation was unexpected, and it came after a decade of broadly sideways movement in participation. And we've also seen the ageing of the population, which we thought would weigh on labour force participation. You can see in this next chart, the increase in participation has been particularly large for women, and there's also been a rise in participation by Australians older than 55. This recent trend reflects a mix of factors, including the wider availability of flexible and part-time work, changes to childcare arrangements, improved health outcomes for older Australians, and changes in the pension age. It's also possible that the higher debt levels and the decline in asset values during the financial crisis have played a role as well. The most important of these factors, though, is the increased availability of flexible and part-time work, with one in three workers in Australia now working part-time. As hours of work have become more flexible, it's become easier for people with caring responsibilities and older Australians to participate in the paid workforce. This change has coincided with another shift in the economy, that is the increasing demand for health services and social assistance, which has led to very, very strong growth in jobs in these areas. Many of these jobs are able to be performed by people who are seeking part-time or flexible work. So there's been a broadly parallel increase in labour demand and labour supply, and this has lessened the upward pressure on wages. The second supply-side factor I wanted to discuss is the ability that firms have had to draw on overseas workers when skills or workers were in short supply in Australia. In some cases, firms hired workers from overseas directly to fill specific skills gaps. But in other cases, they hired people who were already in Australia for other reasons, including to study or on a working holiday. I think it's useful here to distinguish the effects of this ability to draw on overseas labour markets to fill particular gaps from the impact of immigration more broadly. Immigration adds to both the supply of and the demand for labour. When immigrants work, they supply labour, and the consumption of goods and services adds to the demand for labour. With the precise balance between this extra labour supply and this extra labour demand is difficult to determine, and it depends upon the specific circumstances. The picture, though, is clearer when firms are hiring workers to overcome bottlenecks and fill specific gaps where workers are in short supply. This type of hiring dilutes the upward pressure on wages in these hotspots, and it's possible that there are spillover effects to the rest of the labour market. This type of hiring can also dilute the incentive for businesses to train workers to do the required jobs. On the positive side of the ledger, though, hiring overseas workers to overcome bottlenecks allows firms to hire the people they need to operate effectively and to expand and to invest. This benefit was clearly evident during the resources boom, and there are a wide range of businesses and industries that have benefited from being able to hire foreign workers. Without this ability, output in Australia would have been lower. At the time of the previous census, that was back in 2016, there were around 430,000 people working in Australia on temporary visas. So you can see in this next chart, in the food trades, these workers filled around 18% of all jobs. And in the hospitality sector, they filled around 13% of all jobs. Most of these workers were on either temporary visas for skilled workers or student visas, And in the farm sector, it was more common for the workers to be working on working holiday visas. In conceptual terms, one can think of this ability to tap into the global labour market for workers that are in short supply as flattening the supply curve for these workers. A flat supply curve means that a shift in demand has only a small effect on prices, or in this case, wages. And in my view, this is one of the factors that has contributed to wages increases in Australia being less sensitive to shifts in demand than was once the case. The third element of the labour supply story is underemployment. When somebody is underemployed, they are by definition willing to supply more labour, generally at the prevailing wage. This means that when demand is strong, businesses are able to call on underemployed workers to supply more hours without upward pressure on wages. And then when demand is soft, hours can be scaled back. Underemployment has become a much more prominent feature of the Australian labour market over the past decade. Today, over 7% of the labour force report that they're underemployed. You can see in the chart that's more than double the rate in the 1980s. Most of these people work part-time, and on average they're looking for an extra 14 hours a week. That's nearly an extra 2 days. In aggregate, these extra hours amount to around 3% of total hours available to be worked in the economy. You can see that in the bottom line in this graph. The rate of underemployment varies significantly across industries, and it's highly correlated with the share of workers who work part-time. You can see in this next chart, the underemployment rate in the accommodation and food services sector is around 20%, while in mining it's less than 1%. These high rates of underemployment mean that hours of work have become an important margin of adjustment in the Australian labour market. Hours can be scaled up and down when demand changes, rather than the alternative of people being hired and fired. And the benefits of this were evident during the pandemic and during the financial crisis more than a decade ago. Reflecting this shift, the RBA has for some time been close attention to both unemployment and underemployment when assessing the degree of spare capacity in the labour market. So together, these three supply side factors help explain the labour market and wage outcomes over recent times. Strong labour demand was met with a strong supply response. The result was that the price of labour did not move that much. A related factor that I've spoken about recently is the laser-like focus on cost control in Australian business over the past decade or so. This focus has made firms wary of increasing wages, lest it hurt their competitiveness in an environment where it's difficult to increase prices. Many have instead relied on non-wage alternatives to attract and retain their staff. High wages have often been seen as a last resort, especially in an environment where the supply side of the labour market's been so flexible. There's also been a shift by some firms towards variable as opposed to fixed remuneration. This has the advantage to the business of avoiding a permanent increase in their cost base, but allowing higher remuneration to be paid for a time. This shift is evident in the wage price index. The wage price index measure, including bonuses, has increased over most of the available history at the same rate as the measure excluding bonuses. But you can see in the second half of the last decade, the measure including bonuses increased at a faster rate as firms competed for workers, and there are signs that this is now happening again. So there's been a move towards flexible as opposed to fixed remuneration. So what does all this mean for the future? The recent big change on the supply side has been the closure of our international borders. This has contributed to labour shortages in some parts, in some areas of the economy, especially given the strong pickup in labour demand. In turn, some workers have received sizable wage increases. However, the spillover effects to the broader labour market have been limited to date, and wage increases remain modest for most workers. Most firms retain their strong focus on cost control, with many preferring to wait things out until the borders open and ration output in the meantime. The impact of this change on the supply side is evident in the sharp jump in the number of job vacancies, especially in the accommodation and food services sector, which you can see in this next chart. Whereas previously, some of these vacancies could have been filled by people on visas, that's obviously now more difficult. Since March 2020, the number of people in Australia on a visa with the right to work has fallen by over 250,000. It's a very significant decline. Given this experience, an important consideration for us at the moment regarding the outlook is how long the borders remain closed. One plausible scenario is that the borders open gradually over the period ahead, especially for workers with skills that are in short supply. This would relieve some of the current pressure points in the labour market. Alternatively, it's also possible that the borders remain closed for an extended period and that the pressure points build further. If so, aggregate wage growth would pick up more quickly than currently expected, but production and investment would both be considerably constrained. In terms of domestic labour force participation, we're expecting further increases, but not a repeat of the large increase seen since the middle of the previous decade. Increased job opportunities are expected to continue to draw more people into the labour market, which is good news. In addition, the more flexible work arrangements that are one of the legacies of the pandemic make it easier for some people to participate in the labour market. The reforms to childcare will also help, although the ageing of the population works in the other direction. With all these moving parts and the uncertainty about the future strength of labour demand, it is challenging at the moment to determine exactly when the spare capacity in the labour market will be absorbed, and hence when we can expect a sustained lifting wages growth. While it's hard to be sure, it's likely that the unemployment rate will need to be sustained in the low fours for the Australian economy to be considered to be operating at full employment. Underemployment will also need to decline further. And to achieve this, a further period of strong employment growth will be required. One consideration here is that the closure of the borders is making it more difficult to match workers with jobs, opening the possibility that more generalised labour shortages occur at a higher rate of unemployment than we would have expected. Another source of uncertainty here is the lack of historical experience upon which to draw. In the past four decades, the only time that Australia has had an unemployment rate close to 4% was during the peak of the resources boom, and it wasn't sustained at that level for very long. So there is some uncertainty about how aggregate wages growth will respond to lower rates of unemployment. But given this lack of historical experience, two of my colleagues at the RBA, James Bishop and Emma Greenland, have approached the issue from a different angle, and I thought I'd share the results of their work with you. In particular, they've examined the relationship between the unemployment rate in nearly 300 individual local labour markets across Australia and the average increase in labour income in each of these markets using data from the ATO. The results are shown in this next graph. The vertical axis shows how much growth in income in a particular labour market varies from the average, and the horizontal axis shows the unemployment rate in each of the individual local labour markets. The results suggest a clear relationship. The lower unemployment is, the higher is relative income growth. The relationship is stronger when the unemployment rate in a local labour market dips below 5%, and it's strongest when the unemployment rate dips below 4%. While these results are subject to a range of qualifications, they suggest a couple of important conclusions. First, tighter labour markets do generate stronger wage increases. It's comforting, isn't it, that the laws of supply and demand still work. And the second conclusion is that the relationship seems to be stronger at unemployment rates below 5%. These are important conclusions from a policy perspective, especially given that the RBA strategy is to get the unemployment rate down so that wages growth picks up and inflation returns in a sustainable way to the target range. So that brings me to our monetary policy decisions earlier in the week. At our meeting on Tuesday, the Reserve Bank Board agreed to retain the April 2024 bond as the bond for the yield target and to retain the target of 10 basis points. We agreed to continue purchasing government bonds after the completion of the current bond purchase program in early September, and we'll purchase $4 billion a week until at least mid-November. And third, we decided to maintain the cash rate target at 10 basis points and the interest rate on exchange settlement balances at zero. These measures will provide the continuing monetary policy support that the economy needs as it transitions from the recovery phase to the expansion phase. They will help lower unemployment and underemployment further, and in time see a return of inflation to the 2-3% target range. The board is committed to achieving the goals of full employment and inflation consistent with the target. The bond purchase program is helping us make progress towards those goals. We decided to continue purchasing bonds because we are still some way from reaching those goals. However, at the same time, we are responding to the stronger than expected economic recovery and the improved outlook by adjusting the amount purchased each week. This is consistent with the framework that we previously set out. Under that framework, bond purchases are reviewed in terms of first, their effectiveness, second, the decisions of other central banks, and third, and most importantly, the progress towards our goals for inflation and employment. We're seeking to provide as much guidance about future bond purchases as we reasonably can in an uncertain world, while at the same time retaining the flexibility to respond in a timely way to changes in the state of the economy and the outlook. So we will be reviewing the size of our bond purchase again at our November meeting. In terms of interest rates, the condition that the board has set for an increase in the cash rate is that inflation is sustainably within the 2-3% target range. It's not enough for inflation to be forecast to be in this range. We want to see results before we change interest rates, and the bond purchases will end prior to any increase in the cash rate. For inflation to be sustainably in the 2-3% range, it's likely that wages growth will need to exceed 3%. That's on the basis that labour productivity continues to increase and the labour share of national income remains broadly steady. The current rate of wage growth is materially less than 3%. Partly for the reasons that I've discussed today, we still expect the lift in aggregate wages growth to be gradual. We also expect that it will take until 2024 for inflation to be sustainably within the 2-3% target range. I'd like to close by reiterating two points that I made earlier in the week. The first is that the condition for an increase in the cash rate depends upon the data, not the date. It's based on inflation outcomes, not the calendar. And the second is that the step down in the RBA's bond purchases from $5 billion to $4 billion a week does not represent a withdrawal of support by the RBA. The evidence is that central bank bond purchases have their impact through the total stock of bonds purchases, not the flow of those purchases. By mid-November, our cumulative bond purchases under the bond purchase program will have amounted to $237 billion. We will hold a little more than 30% of Australian government bonds on issue and a little more than 15% of state and territory bonds on issue. This represents a substantial and ongoing degree of support to the Australian economy. The adjustment in the rate of weekly purchases does not change this. Michael, let me conclude on that note. Thank you very much for listening, and I look forward to answering your questions.
Well, my two questions refer to Ben Bernanke's presidential address to the American Economics Association on the 4th of January 2020. It was in San Diego, and I was lucky enough to be there sitting in the second row. And the speech was called New Tools for Monetary Policy. Ben Bernanke says that the neutral interest rate is the interest rate consistent with full employment and inflation at the target in the long run. Most current estimates of the nominal neutral rate for the United States are in the range between 2 and 3%, and the median projection of FOMC participants, even in the most recent summary of economic projections, it's 2.5%. The problem, Bernanke says, is that the Fed needs to cut cut rates in an average downturn by about 5.5%. And Bernanke says that the nominal neutral rate, that a nominal neutral rate at 5.5% would require lifting the inflation target by 3% from 2% now all the way up to 5%. On the other hand, he says quantitative easing and forward guidance can provide an additional 3% increase in policy space to offset the facts of the effects of the lower bound on short-term rates. And this suggests that at a nominal neutral rate of 2.5%, quantitative easing will be necessary in almost all future business cycles, and we'll have to provide at least 3/5 of all the monetary easing in future slumps. So the first question, Governor, is do you think that quantitative easing will be necessary in almost all future business cycles, and will it have to do the heavy lifting to provide the stimulus in future economic slumps?
Thank you, Michael. It's a great question. It's quite probable that bond purchases will have a role to play in managing the cycle in the future. But I do think there are limits here. There's a limit to how much of the existing stock of assets that makes sense for the central bank to buy. The effects of these asset purchases are cumulative. Each time we go through a cycle, you'll own more and more of the assets, unless the assets that we buy in one cycle are sold or mature before the next one starts. So there are limits here. The central bank can't keep on buying up existing stock of assets. I don't think it makes sense to do that. So we do need other options to manage the next cycle. I think the first of these options, and we shouldn't forget this, is conventional interest rate policy. And this is one reason why that we're keen to get the inflation rate back to 2 to 3%. If we can get it back to 2 to 3% sustainably, then interest rates will be able to be normalized. And that means that when the next downturn comes, we'll be able to inject monetary stimulus through the standard way of lowering the cash rate. I think it's important that we get some firepower back eventually so that we can respond to the next downturn. We know there will be another downturn and we will want a monetary policy response. The second option that needs to be on the table is fiscal policy. We've seen over the past year and a bit fiscal policy play an incredibly constructive role during the pandemic. And it's quite likely, I think, that if interest rates are going to be at low levels for many years, the fiscal policy is going to need to play a bigger role in the future. If monetary policy is constrained because there is a limit to how many assets that you can ultimately buy and the ability to cut interest rates is limited because rates are already low, then fiscal policy is going to have to play a bigger role. And I know the Treasury are thinking about mechanisms and approaches to make that effective, because we all know there are challenges here in using fiscal policy in a counter-cyclical sense. So quantitative easing will have an ongoing role, but I think it'd be unwise to rely on that as the main instrument of macroeconomic management.
Okay, my second question. Raghu Rajan, in setting up the monetary policy targets for the Reserve Bank of India, selected a higher inflation target of 4%. And Olivier Blanchard has also suggested a higher inflation target than the level of 2%. A higher inflation target would solve some of the problem caused by the lower long-term nominal neutral rate. Now, we've just had a surprise international agreement, as a result of a lot of work by the OECD in increasing the minimum level of company tax. So do you think there's ever a prospect of an international agreement between central banks to increase the inflation target from the current level of around about 2%?
Well, there are no such discussions going on at the moment. Our current discussions are about how we can achieve the targets we have. And I was on another conference call last night discussing that set of issues. So we're really focused at the moment on achieving the targets that we have, which we've struggled to do over the past decade, rather than to set even higher targets to achieve. there's a general agreement that what we should be striving for is a low positive rate of inflation that doesn't materially distort decision-making in the economy. The widespread consensus is that that number is somewhere between 2 and 3%, and that if you have higher rates of inflation, say 4 or 5%, then you will see start to see distortions in the economy. So a low and stable rate of inflation, I think, is the best way of dealing with the situation. I think the other general consideration that we talk about in our meetings is that if you change the target once, that opens up the possibility of further changes in the future. And there's some risk that you could unanchor inflation and wage expectations. I think that's not an argument for never making a change, but it does mean that the hurdle for making a change to inflation targets quite high. There needs to be a compelling argument that we'd get better outcomes for the society by targeting an inflation rate of 3 or 4 than the current rate to make the change. And my view and the view of my colleagues is the compelling arguments aren't there yet. Not to say they couldn't emerge in the future, but they're not there yet.
Thanks very much for the presentation, Governor Lowe. We have questions coming in thick and fast from the audience, and I'd like to start with a couple from high school students. So first of all, we have one from Shay Baggett. She's studying Year 12 Economics at Penrith Selective High School. And the question is, with the cash rate at a record low of 0.1%, is there any possibility that Australia may consider a negative cash rate? And if so, what implications will this have on our economy?
The answer to that is that we're not considering a negative interest rate. I think the time for that consideration is past. The economy is doing better, and it would be a curious decision, given the strength of the economy now, for us to move into negative territory. So that's the cyclical situation. Even before the recovery was strong, we had a very low appetite for negative interest rates. The evidence, at least my reading of the evidence, is that negative interest rates have not been particularly successful. And you might have noticed that during the pandemic, no country that was in positive territory went to negative, and the central banks that were in negative territory didn't go further negative. There's a reason for that, and that is that it doesn't seem particularly effective. Negative rates start to cause problems in the banking system. Banking profitability can decline, and banks may not be as prepared to make loans. And we also saw in some countries that people responded to negative interest rates by saving more. You put $100 in the bank today, and the bank tells you you're only going to get back 98 at the end of the year. That might encourage people to save more. Lower interest rates are supposed to encourage people to save less and spend more. So the effects can be perverse. So we don't need to consider it now because the economy is improving, but even when the economy was in a hole, we weren't considering it either. Thank you.
Another question from an economics student, Dr. Lowe. What implications have been observed from the other unconventional measures that the RBA has implemented, such as the TFF, and how do you see the conduct of these policies evolving in the future?
The TFF has been really important in keeping the funding costs down for the banking system. We've lent almost $200 billion to the banks at an interest rate of 0.11% for 3 years, and that's allowed the banks to make low interest rate loans to people, and it's also meant the banks have had a lot of liquidity so that they've had the liquidity to support businesses and customers. So it's been really important. The term funding facility now is closed to new drawings, but those loans are out there for 3 years, so they're going to keep funding costs down in the economy for the next 3 years. I would hope that going forward, we don't need to have a repeat of that. I don't see any signs of stress in the financial system that would require it, and I hope that we wouldn't need to do that again in the future, but it's a tool that we do have if we saw stresses in the financial system, which at the moment there are no signs of. And you asked about the other unconventional policies. That I think the bond purchases have been really important in lowering the whole structure of the yield curve in Australia. That helps keep interest rates down for borrowers. Lower interest rates give people cash flow, so businesses and households have more money to spend. And the lower interest rates have also pushed up asset prices and thereby supporting balance sheets. I think through those channels, what used to be called unconventional policies have actually supported jobs in Australia and supported the recovery we've experienced.
I'm sure you're spurring on many high school economics essays as we speak. Great answer. I'm going to move now to one from Tapas Strickland at NAB. So you mentioned you weren't inclined to move the inflation target, but he asks, given that you won't expect inflation to take hold until 2024 to be sustainably within the target until 2024, do you think there is any need to let inflation run above the midpoint for a time to anchor inflation expectations and maximise the probability of it being sustained within the target?
It's a good question. My immediate challenge is to get inflation to the 2 to 3% target. And I don't think that's going to happen until 2024. So we haven't kind of formally considered the issue of whether there's benefit in having inflation run above the target for a number of years. That issue we'll have to confront at some point, but it's not one that we've turned our minds to yet. My main focus is actually getting the inflation rate back to the 2 to 3% range. And the main way for us to do that is to get unemployment lower, get underemployment lower, so that firms who are reticent to pay bigger wage rises have to actually pay bigger wage rises. Wages start increasing at 3+%, and eventually that will translate into higher inflation. So that's our focus, and it's going to remain the focus for the next couple of years.
I've got a question now from James. He's wondering, why do you think there is a disconnect between the RBA and the private sector's expectations on the timing of the next cash rate rise? Is it due to differences in wage growth expectations, differences in modelling, or is the private sector just overly optimistic about the future path of the pandemic?
Well, I can only speak for our views. So perhaps I can repeat our view again for you, and then other people can judge why the private sector has a different view. And our fundamental assessment is that these factors that have kept wages growth low, while they're going to gradually dissipate, it's going to take a long time. The last time that wages growth in Australia was above 3% was a decade ago. It took a decade to go from 3% to 1.5%. There were kind of powerful and deep structural factors at work. There was the supply response I've talked about as well, the business psychology. I don't see those factors going away quickly. They were there for a decade. They're fundamental. They're global. I don't see them turning around quickly. And because we don't see them turning around quickly, we think the grind higher in wages will be slow. And if wages growth is still running with a 2 in front of it, it's going to be very difficult for us to deliver an inflation rate starting with 2 or 2.5. So that process is going to take time to work through. There's two possibilities why the market has a different view. One is that they think the closure of the borders will lead to a hothouse environment and wages will pick up more quickly. So that's possible, but I think it's a more plausible scenario that eventually, over time, the borders open again and some of the hothouse pressure points in the labour market dissipate. The other, at least conceptual, possibility is that the markets don't believe our reaction function. I sometimes read commentary that will raise interest rates to choke off housing prices. And with housing prices rising quickly, the Reserve Bank will kind of raise interest rates to choke that off. That's a misunderstanding of our reaction function. We won't be raising interest rates to choke off housing price increases. if borrowing is unsustainable, then we'd be talking with APRA about prudential tools. But we're not going to use monetary policy to deal with rising housing prices. It'd be the wrong thing to do, and I don't think it would work. So some people kind of think we'll do that. So if I can disabuse anyone who has that view that there's any probability of that being in our reaction function, then thank you for giving me the opportunity to do that.
Well, thank you. I think that was pretty crystal clear. We've had a couple of questions. You mentioned assumptions around border reopenings there, Dr. Lowe. What is the RBA's assumption about when the international border opens?
Well, in the last set of forecasts, it was kind of we'd proceeding on the basis that it opened around the end of this year. So we're about to undertake a new forecasting round. We'll have to make another assessment. I think in terms of wage pressures, what's really important is not the generalised opening of the borders, but allowing workers to come into the country where there are skills that are in short supply or we can't find the workers, because it's these pressure points that can build that we get large wage increases in those pressure points and they spill over to the rest of the community. So I know from many of my meetings with businesses that they're struggling to find the workers that they want, and I note that government ministers have spoken about this issue as well, and it's one of the priority areas that they're focusing on. So if that doesn't happen, if the borders remain completely closed and we can't get workers into the country that are needed for firms to expand and invest, I think we will see more wages growth. Some people might think that's good. On the other hand, we'll see less investment, less confident businesses, lower output, and ultimately a lower capital stock and kind of a less dynamic economy. So it's a really first order issue, and we're proceeding on the basis that over the next 6 months or so, a way will be found gradually to allow the workers who are most needed to get into the country. If that doesn't happen, then the outlook looks quite different.
Great. I've got a question from Michael Potter, who is responding to some of your comments on the impact of immigration on labour markets. He says, your comments could be interpreted as a criticism of the use of overseas workers. However, international trade in anything, including labour, suggests it should make both countries better off in the absence of externalities. Can you address concerns that you might be criticising the use of overseas workers?
Well, I'm certainly not criticising the use of overseas workers. I'm trying to apply an analytical lens to it and say, well, what effects did this have? As I said in my prepared remarks, allowing workers with skills in short supply into the country allowed businesses to expand and invest, increase the productive capital base of Australia. Imagine during the resources boom, we hadn't been able to draw on the global labour market. We wouldn't have been able to have all that investment, which is fundamental to Australia's prosperity. So having overseas workers come into the country is incredibly beneficial. But applying this analytical lens, I think it does take the pressure off some of the hotspots in the local labour market. If we hadn't had 500,000 people in the country who were on these temporary visas, then I think we would have had more hotspots in the labour market, which would have temporarily given us higher wage increases, but ultimately would have given us lower levels of output and a lower capital stock. So I'm certainly not criticising this at all. I'm trying to understand the implications of it for wages, output and investment. And I look forward to the day that the borders are open again and businesses can once again benefit from tapping into a global labour market.
Fantastic. Thank you. Also very clear. A question from Zach Gross at Monash University. He takes the point that the stock of bond purchases is the best measure for support for the economy, but he notes keeping purchases at $5 billion per week would mean a higher stock and thus more support. So why did the RBA choose to have a smaller stock of bond purchases when inflation is still so far below target?
Right when we started these bond purchases, we set out a framework that we were going to use to analyse them, our future decisions. And as I said before, that framework was based on the effectiveness of them, what other central banks are doing, and the progress we've made towards our goals. Back in February, as I said in my prepared remarks, we thought the unemployment rate today would be 6.5%. It's 5.1, and job vacancies are at a record level. So we thought, consistent with the framework that we've articulated, the third and most important consideration was progress towards our goals, we made progress. And if we didn't decide to scale back when we've made such substantial progress, I don't know when we would decide to scale back. So it's a modest scaling back, and it's reflecting the progress that we've made. We're going to keep buying these bonds until we make more material progress. And really what we want to see, the key thing we want to see, is evidence that the stronger growth in jobs and output is translating into stronger increases in wages and inflation. So we're going to keep going until that happens. But as we get closer to those objectives, I hope you can understand that it makes sense to kind of scale back a bit. And then by the time we get to those objectives, we will finish this. So it's really a response to the stronger economy.
Thank you. I think we've probably got time for one more question. I am seeing a lot of questions coming through on property prices. I know you've been extremely clear that you won't be using monetary policy settings to deal with high and rising prices, but a number coming in from economics teachers in particular, so I think this might be part of the syllabus as well. What more do you think the government or others should be doing if we're not going to be using monetary policy to manage the increase in property prices?
I'm generally not in the business of telling others what they should be doing. I'm in the business of putting an analytical kind of prism over what's happening and trying to understand it. And low interest rates are pushing up housing prices. It's not just in Australia, but everywhere around the world. We need these low interest rates to get people into jobs, to get wages moving, to get inflation back to target. So from my perspective, back onto kind of the monetary policy reaction function, if we were to use interest rates to slow housing prices, that would be effective for a while at least, but it would mean fewer people had jobs, wage increases would be lower, and inflation would be lower. Doesn't seem a particularly good trade-off to me. And it's not one that our mandate would allow us to make anyhow. The question is that you asked, which is good, what else can be done? I'm not saying this should be done, but the reason, the structural reasons we have high housing prices in Australia relate to, it's all about supply and demand. A lot of us want to live in these fantastic global cities on the coast, on large blocks of land, and we've chronically underinvested in transport. So I think if you said this is a first-year economic question and said, if you live in a country where everyone wants to live in, kind of squeezed into fantastic global cities on the coast, on large blocks of land, you don't have much transport, you know, you haven't invested much in transport, and the government gives you incentives to do that, would that country have high or low housing prices? I think most students would answer that high. So that's why we've got structurally high housing prices in the country. So if the society wants to do something about that, it has to address those issues. Those issues about where we live, how we invest in transport, and how we tax land. I'll leave it to others to decide to comment on whether we should move on some of those things. My view is we should, but I'm not going to go into any specifics.
Well, thank you very much. I think there were certainly some policy solutions nodded to there at the very least. Thank you so much for your time, Governor Lowe. You know, it's certainly a very interesting time for macroeconomic policy, and I think this type of speech and your willingness to respond to so many different questions is incredibly important for shedding light on the Reserve Bank's direction and thinking. So thank you again on behalf of the Economic Society.
Thank you very much, and I look forward to visiting Brisbane soon.